We want to thank y'all for tuning in to Run Up the Numbers.
Every Monday at 8 a.m., and if you missed us in the morning, you can catch the replay in the afternoon at 2 p.m. and again at 8. You can also check out the shows archived over at thenumbers.fm. And for you early risers, every Monday morning at 6 a.m. on 107.1 X-Ray FM.
Make sure you're following us on all social media because we out here.
Yes.
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram,
yes.
House Party,
yes.
YouTube,
there.
Twitch, Black Planet. I know y'all talking about our OnlyFans. It's going crazy in there. MySpace, Tinder, catch us ticking on the talk and Google Plus. We want to thank y'all for tuning in to Run Up the Numbers. Ken, how are you, sir?
I am doing a well. One good. Well.
All right. One well?
One well, please.
I'll have two. It's been a good week. It's been
double
a good
up.
Week.
Okay.
Really, really excited for you guys to tune in for this particular episode, part of our series with CEP. Mm-hmm. Today, we are joined by Anissa Pemberton, Environmental Partnership Manager of Coalition of Communities of Color. Anissa, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for letting me join y'all. I'm excited.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's jump right into it. What brought you to this work in the clean energy sector?
Yeah. So I grew up in rural Illinois. I grew up in a town that was an industrial agricultural town. And so, you know, from an early age, I started to see like the impacts of environmental injustice. You know, we had a tire burning fire that happened when I was really young. And it just kind of devastated the town for a while. We had a bunch of factories in the town. And so when I got into college, I grew up in a very conservative household. I should add that, because when I got into college, I really was able to start exploring, like, why were these things happening and why were they happening to my community? And that's when I started to really kind of deep dive into the history of white supremacy, the current context of white supremacy, how my cultural history fit into it. And I started seeing these connections between that and the environment. And I never really thought of myself as an environmentalist until then. And then I started realizing, wow, all these connections are right in front of me this whole time. So after college, I worked for an immigrant rights organization as a grant writer. And then I ended up moving over here because I was sort of just felt very limited in Illinois in terms of what I could do. And so I ended up moving out to Oregon in 2016. And I worked as an AmeriCorps Vista for a couple years and at a disability rights organization. And then I ended up getting lucky pretty much. I was looking to get into climate work. I really wanted it to be a justice-based work. And I saw an ad one day for 350 PDX. They were hiring I think it was called an equity coordinator. And I was like, oh, I think I'm might actually be qualified for this job. And little did I know, I was. And I applied and I got it. And ever since then, I've been involved in the movement for climate justice and all the intersectional realities that come with that, you know. So involved in conversations around police violence, housing, food, access, transportation. You know, climate justice is this really broad label that we use.
Right.
But it really is looking at how we transition our economy away from an extractive system that mostly extracts from Black and Brown communities and low-income communities to a system that is regenerative, that allows people to really thrive and make their own self-determination about what they want in life.
Okay. So right quick, with the tire burning, was that a single event or was that like a yearly?
Oh, you know, it was a singular event. It was an
okay.
accident. There's Got rumors it. In the town about what happened, but there was okay. a tire recycling plant. Can't substantiate any of those rumors. Small town cheese may, you know. But there was a tire recycling plant. And one year it caught on fire. And nobody's quite sure how it caught on fire, but it was in the center of town. So there was just like black plumes of smoke. It was maybe five blocks from where I lived. It ended up pretty much devastating the environment there for a while. And that was kind of on top of already a really like poorly set up community in terms of environmental sustainability. all the farms around me were often owned by farmers, but they were often like controlled by these bigger agricultural companies. I don't know exactly how all that works, but my understanding is like they own the seeds, they own certain parts of the land. And so the area was just really oversaturated with agricultural activity, and in a way that was really unsustainable. Our main product was corn. And so, and that was kind of cute though, because they had like corn festivals. That was cute. I'll admit, like, I still like corn. I didn't eat corn for like 2 years though. After I left that area, I was so fed up with corn.
Ken, thanks for pulling on that thread, because I was like, wait, mysterious circumstances. It went to like a Scooby-Doo thing in my head. It's like this ghost of old man Jedediah. Like, what is happening where there's just plumes of smoke all of a sudden?
I mean, who knows? It was probably somebody with a cigarette, you know? Like, yeah, something that's just, right. I mean, that's most likely. Flip.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's most likely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting how often we're having this conversation now around climate justice and just the environment in general. Mm-hmm. In the town I grew up in, there are four to five trash to steam plants within a 10-mile radius. And I didn't think about that when I was there. I remember having conversations with some of my family members after the fact, talking about, you know, the generational effects on the health of the people in that community, and, you know, how that, you know, can just trickle into so many different facets of our life. But then we have like a big environmental situation, like what happened in, oh goodness, the water. Where was that?
We're talking about Ferguson?
Flint.
No, Flint.
Flint.
Okay. Flint. This is like so many places. Are you talking about all the different places that happened in
Michigan? It's a mess.
Yeah. It's so crazy. I can't remember the name of the town. We actually took some water out there too. But when Flint happened, it was like, how could this be going on in America? We're the greatest nation in the world, and this is happening. But similar circumstances are playing out everywhere. And I'm just happy this is a part of the conversation now.
Yeah, I learned recently that there's actually a big lead concern in Portland, particularly in older buildings like mine. So for anyone listening, you can get a lead test from the government, and you can basically test your water to make sure it's safe. But it is a concern all over the country. You know, our infrastructure in the United States is deeply outdated. And if it wasn't a government-owned property, it may not be updated. That's all I'll say. Like, I don't know the statistics on that, but it's something to keep an eye on for BIPOC folks in particular. I know I live in like a really old apartment. So I feel like a lot of us do.
Okay. Well, I got a question. As far as your role at CCC, there was something that I saw phrasing, the we gather, we grow, we build approach to things. Like, can you explain that idea?
Yeah. So as a coalition, so we're a coalition of culturally specific organizations. So I'll go through the order. So we gather, so we bring together a diverse set of culturally specific organizations to find commonalities around what our communities are facing. We build, so we build like movements, basically. I think of CCC as kind of a grass tops organization in some ways, because we're like, we're a coalition. We're kind of helping other people organize enough so that they don't have to get distracted by their work or from their work. Because a lot of our organizations are, you know, doing the daily survival meets of our communities. And they don't always have time or the capacity to do a lot of deep advocacy. So we build the capacity to really ensure that folks can get their voices heard, whether or not they have a professional lobby advocacy staff on their own staff. And then what was the last one? It was my presentation.
We build.
Oh, it was we gather, we grow, and we build, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I kind of did both at once. Okay. It wasn't as smooth as my presentation to you was.
Yeah. I just wanted to hit with that because that definitely stood out to me. And, you know, just kind of definitively, this is the process and this is what we do. I felt like that was something for the people's ears to catch a piece of.
So yeah.
What is the work of building relationships and strategic partnership? What does that entail?
I see my role as kind of like the cheerleader in the movement sometimes. Like, I feel like I do a lot of work to make spaces feel less heavy and to do conflict resolution. Obviously there is a lot of like seeking out new partners, but there's a lot of like continuing partnerships that are decades old in some cases and have complicated histories, especially with the white dominant environmental groups. There's very complicated histories with some of those organizations. And my job really is to look at, you know, how can I serve our coalition members in those spaces and make sure that the partnerships are serving their needs, are serving our goals, and aren't really beneficial to our communities at the end of the day. I think it is tricky to operate with some of these white dominant, larger environmental groups or labor groups, or other groups that might have some alignment with us and some differences from us, and figuring out how to, sometimes I feel like I'm making up like midpoint solutions in a meeting. I do a lot of facilitation. So I listen to people talk and then I try to find something, some proposal, and sometimes I'm totally off the mark, but some proposal that can be kind of a midpoint where everybody can be like, okay, I'm cool with that. I can accept that. That's all right. And like I said, sometimes there isn't. Sometimes it's like, nope, we just simply disagree. We're not going to be able to work together on this project. How can we work together on other things? So really finding those points of alignment, I feel like, is a lot of what I do.
What are some of the reoccurring differences that you find in having these conversations with some of the larger companies?
I think, one of the big differences is like there is a difference between justice and equity. And people aren't always aware of what that difference is. And in my own head, at least this is how I understand it, justice is like the endpoint, like where I want to go, and equity is like a tool to get there. And some people see equity as the endpoint. And I don't really think that. Like, I'm a collective liberationist. So I think depending on where you come from and what your lived experience might be, you might think equity is good enough, you know? And right. To me, it's like it's not there yet. It's like, it's useful. I'm glad we got a step up, you know, but it's not the end point. Like, I want that fence. I don't know if you've ever seen this graphic, but there's a really interesting graphic that's gone around and been reshaped over the years. But the image is of, I believe, a brown man who is like standing next to another brown man, and the other brown man is shorter. And so they put a box up so he can see over the fence to the baseball game, right? I want that fence taken down. Like, why is there a fence there?
Like, no one ever asked that question. Why is there a fence there?
Yeah. So I think that's like often where we come into some points of conflict. I think the other issue is politics is about power. So when certain groups get more power, even if it's like values aligned for those groups to get more power, there's always going to be an equal or greater backlash to that power. And I think we've seen that with the racial justice uprising in the past year. You know, we saw all this energy and all this movement and all this promising activity, and not to say that there's still not the promise there, but we're seeing like a conservative backlash through the People for Portland campaign, for example. So I think similarly on like a micro scale within the environmental movement, you know, as environmental justice groups have taken more of leadership, there is a bit of a power dynamic that's playing out where these groups that were used to leading are now being told, hey, you follow us now, you listen to us now. And not everybody wants to do that. Some folks are great. I think specifically, you know, when we talk later about the Portland Clean Energy Fund, we can talk about like some really awesome ways that environmental groups have shown up. But I think that's a big point of conflict. And then with labor groups, there's a lot of tension between labor and environmental groups. I think we've worked through a lot of it, so I don't want to overestimate it. But one of the biggest factors is that labor organizations are constantly looking for new jobs. They want to increase employment, and that can sometimes be at odds with what is actually the most environmentally sound thing to do. So for example, the Jordan Cove project down in Southern Oregon, they were talking about building a pipeline through Jordan Cove, which is an indigenous area. and labor and environmental groups were at odds on this forever because there was going to be jobs coming in. And so a lot of the labor organizations were really excited about those jobs. But the environmental organizations were like, we're going to decimate an entire community if we do this. And so those points of tension are sometimes really hard, even when you're not talking about that thing. You can come into a room and you're not talking about Jordan Cove, but Jordan Cove is like right there and everyone's aware of it. And now the environmentalists have kind of mostly won that battle. So like everybody's kind of aware of it. And it's like, it's an unspoken dynamic, but it can impact relationships over time, I think, like individual relationships, because when you're in conflict over something you feel really passionate about, it's easy to start to personalize that. It's easy for it to be attached to your ego. I'll speak for myself. That happens to me sometimes. So I recognize that it's just very tricky. You know, when we have people doing this work, it's never going to look perfect. It's going to look messy, and there's going to be a lot of differences.
Okay. Well, clean energy is often framed as a job killer in political media. Can you talk about the job creation implications of clean energy investment?
Yeah, there is a lot of opportunity there. So when we think about like the fossil fuel industrial complex, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's think about how many jobs are involved with currently supplying our current energy system. Okay. And I think the question that climate justice movements are asking is, what if we reemployed those same people into a field that is sustainable? So the goal is not to get anyone out of work. The goal is to like keep people employed, expand the employment field so that people like me and you can actually, I don't know, apply and have a good chance of getting a job in that field. And then also like really thinking about how do we grow wealth. So I think wealth creation is a big topic of conversation. So another thing to think, to keep in mind with clean energy is just cheaper than fossil fuels. And so when it comes down to cost, it's going to be less money, especially in the state of Oregon, for us to have clean energy. So when we're talking about wealth creation and helping people stay employed and able to stay in their homes, I think it's kind of a win-win now. I will say that, like, even with that said, a lot of people are really skeptical of that. And I think for good reasons, because capitalism is fickle sometimes. So like we can have the best of intentions with setting out on something, but like we got to dot our T's, cross our I's, you know, all that stuff. I didn't say that right. But all that stuff, you got to like double check everything and make sure that you're on the right track. And I think that's where like community-based organizations in particular doing this work is really helpful, because we do have to be accountable to our members. And if we're not doing the right thing, like if CCC just stopped listening to our member groups, we wouldn't exist anymore. We have a check of accountability in community-based organizations that I think just frankly does not exist in a corporate atmosphere. In a corporate atmosphere, the goal is to make money, and that's about it.
It's so interesting to talk about the lack of understanding, or maybe just not, I don't know, just lack of foresight in seeing how emerging technology will create new jobs. That's all I think about. It's like, okay, we're doing a new thing. Someone has to learn how to do this new thing. So there's jobs in teaching it, jobs in implementing this new process. It's always been that easy for me. And I mean, some of it may just be you know, growing up, watching certain shows, you're always looking at the future, whether it's the long distant future or just the Jetsons. And that's the world. Like, I can't wait till we can get this technology. I always want to be in that future. No one wants to live in like the dystopian Blade Runner. Like, no one wants to live in a broken down future. So whenever I hear about this new technology, it's like, yeah, let's go to there. Let's do everything we can to do that. Can sent us a text yesterday about 3D printed meat.
And I've heard of this.
I'm going to tell you the truth. At first, I was like, this is scary. What are they using to make this with? I didn't judge. I watched the video. Beet juice. Soy. I'll allow
plastic
it.
Plastic shavings.
Wait a minute. No one said anything about that. and if there's plastic shavings in there and I don't know about it. Is it not meat? Is it a great alternative? Sure. Like, future thinking, looking to the future, moving forward. I'm down with all of the innovation, all of it.
You know, I love that take on it. Then we also can take a walk through any Walmart. Realize of how many people stay in a time capsule and don't want the world to keep moving.
True.
They want it to be exactly as it is because that's what they know.
Yeah.
And those are the people fighting tooth and nail against this.
I think that really hits at a core issue with this. It's more like mental, actually. Yeah. It's more about your mindset. Yeah. Because I find, like, my parents are very conservative. And they'll just tend to, whatever I bring up, like, we should really transition the economy. They're like, yeah, eventually. Not now, though. Not now.
Later.
When we're in Mad Max territory, then we can talk. And it's like, no, now, before it gets to Mad Max territory. Oh, like, come on.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny because, like, I often think about that, like, how... And it's not just a generational thing. It's just purely, like, I think what people... have been exposed to, what people understand about the possibilities and what limitations have been put on us by, you know, the systems that we live in, that we, and I talk about this all the time, like not being able to always figure out, like, how do we thrive in a system where we're basically set up to, like, have to struggle just to survive. I mean, like, getting to that thriving piece is really challenging. And I think that's often where people kind of hit a wall. They're like, they've been stuck in a survival mode for so long that that's like the best they think they can have. But I gotta tell y'all, we can do better. Jeez, we can do a lot better.
You guys just tied two concepts together for me real tight. Being stuck in that survival mode and then also being constantly romanced by nostalgia. So it's like, this is how it's always been, you know, getting it out the mud. You know, by the sweat of my brow, I'm used to that survival. Mm-hmm. I don't want to try this, whatever this new version of survival might be. Yeah. I don't even want to think about it. Give me the devil I know. It's that much better.
Yeah.
Man. This is why I won't let go of my old Presto pressure cooker, the lock and lid. New digital technology? I will have none of it in my kitchen.
It's the pot foolishness.
keep that over there.
Let me ask you this. Where is funding most needed in clean energy projects?
It's a good question. I think in community-based energy projects. So the work that Community Energy Project does and that Verde Builds does and other groups do, I think is really, that's where I see the most chance for communities to have some control over how we interact with our energy system. And I think ultimately, like, I would like to see our communities have more collective power in literally how our power comes to us. I mean, because it's concerning to me, a pattern I've seen, you know, especially over the pandemic, when the economy goes down and we allow people, you know, a respite from their bills, truth is that they're going to come back and ask for all that money. But what if it was a community-based system where people could negotiate it, where they could own some of the solar or the wind, and so that they didn't have to worry about their energy bills every month because they owned a solar panel, they made an investment, they pay a bottom line on it. Like, that sort of stuff really excites me. I think energy affordability as well is a place of growth. So it's energy burden is the largest driver of payday loans and credit card debt in the country. And the reason for this is because energy bills fluctuate so much that certain communities, and I know I still have energy debt, certain communities, if you live in a bad apartment like I do now with like bad insulation and you can't afford for your bill to get ticked up another $100 randomly in the winter, in the summer when you use more energy, suddenly you're like, well, I only make, you know, when I had this happen to me, I think I only made $1,000 a month. Like, I only make $1,000 a month. I have a credit card. I don't have any cash on me. I'll put it on my credit card. But it's more often payday loans, which is concerning because payday loans are very exploitive. And a lot of people end up doing payday loans so that they can get to their next paycheck. And in their head, it's like, oh, I'm not taking on a debt, but they really are. And so I would like to see more energy affordability options where people get, you know, now we're going to have the ratepayer class system soon. So people will be put into ratepayer classes based on their income. So that'll be one tool that we'll have in Oregon, at least. But I would love to see things like direct payments to people, like direct like support to low-income people for their energy bills. Because it's not probably fully going to answer the question of how do people pay for their energy. And for me, I guess I'm more concerned about the economic side of it a lot of the time, because I think that's where we can make some long-term changes and things that will really impact people's lives. You know, we can talk about polar bears all day long, but let's be honest, like, people need cash. Like, they need cash.
Yeah.
Facts.
Yes.
It is what it is. Yep.
Great way to put a button on that. Well, what can you tell us about Bill 26-201?
Sure. So that was a ballot measure. When I mentioned that I worked at 350 PDX, this was actually what I came in to work on, partly. So I started off as a field coordinator for the campaign. The ballot is called Portland Clean Energy Fund Benefits Initiative. The goal, it's a very long title. Now we just call it the Portland Clean Energy Fund, or if you're really you're in the in-group, you call it PCEF.
Yes. That's sure. What we call it around
this. Yeah. Yeah. It. Y'all in the group, you know. So I'll probably call it PCEF quite a bit for folks listening in, but that's what I'm referring to. So PCEF established a grant program at the city of Portland that aims to distribute $60 million a year to low income and BIPOC community based organizations to do a clean energy transition. I will say that one of the common misconceptions about PCEF is that this is enough money to pay for the energy transition in Portland in total. It's not. Residential buildings alone will cost $3 billion. So we're working still at a deficit, but it was a huge win for our communities. The money is distributed by a grant committee that is made up of, I believe it's 80% BIPOC representation currently. But the requirements for the committee is that they represent east of 82nd to some degree, that they represent a wide variety of different technical fields, and that they do they have some lived experience in the clean energy world or in racism to participate. So it's a great grant committee, super engaged. For volunteers, they throw down so much hours. It's a second part-time job. I mean, it's a lot of work to get that program running. So last year we distributed out $8 million in grants. These all went to entirely BIPOC and low-income communities. A lot of them were planning grants because folks needed to have a year to kind of figure out like all the details basically before they came out for a bigger proposal. The good news about this is that PCEF has no sunset. So it will exist until somebody, well, as long as we defend it, to be honest. I mean, that's the real thing that I do a lot of is defending the program, is making sure the program is protected. But overall, I was really excited about all of the grantees that got grants last year. I saw a lot of promising projects. And the thing that excites me most of all is because it has no sunset, people can apply for 3-year, 5-year projects, which is great. So if you're a community-based organization listening in, you don't have to come in with a fully scoped out idea. You could have a year of planning and you could still get a 5-year grant, which I think some of the organizations maybe didn't understand, or maybe they just felt like, you know what, we can still use this time. Like, we still want to do this work. I don't know, but I just want to mention that like people shouldn't limit themselves and feel like they have to come in and have all the answers to all the questions figured out. Really, we're looking for projects that really serve the greatest needs of these communities, and that are really community connected, are really based in what communities are asking for.
That's excellent information.
Yes.
Ken, I think it's time we start that project that we were talking about.
Yeah, y'all's eyes lit up. I was like, there's something behind those eyes. I don't know what that is, but there's something there.
You did talk about a sunroom.
You know. What did the pushback to the bill look like at the time, and what effect did local political organizing have on overcoming it?
Yeah, so our main oppositional group was the Portland Business Alliance, good old PBA. I will refer to them as PBA from time to time. So I believe they pledged $5 million against the campaign, but I think they only spent $2.5 to $3 million. And we, on the opposite end, I think we had about a $700,000 budget. Wow. So we were up against it. The first thing they did was, before it even went onto the ballot or up for a petition for the ballot, they sued us in court to say it wasn't legal after we initially like expressed interest. The court shot that down. So we were able to put it up for petition. So at that point we were in signature gathering phase. Their main argument against the program was that it was going to raise prices on low income people. I should back up. So the surcharge that created this program, where all this money comes from, is a 1% business license surcharge on billion-dollar corporations that make over $500,000 in the city of Portland. Okay. So the business license surcharge is on their profits. It's not on like day-to-day costs. So if you go buy a broom, it's not really supposed to impact that. Legally, however, they can put it on receipts. So some corporations ended up putting it on their receipts, but what we found is that it's pretty minimal and nobody really cared about it. It does exclude any profits made off of groceries, medicine, utilities. Yeah, I think those are the big three. So it does exclude some products that folks might be selling. And the point of that was to avoid raising costs if any costs did get raised, which, like I said, it doesn't seem like it's really borne out into reality. So yeah, they used a lot of the typical kind of scare techniques of like, these communities are well-intentioned, but they don't know what they're doing. Oh, wow. That was a big one. The, like I said, raising costs was a big one. And then, you know, the good old, like, if costs raise, then what will happen to the jobs? And a lot of that kind of their typical kind of conservative talking points about raising any sort of revenue for anything. I mean, I feel like this comes up every time we talk.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
Unless it's the military. Or the police.
Then we always have money. We have tons of money for the military. Always.
Yeah, lots of money. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, PPB too. But yeah, so like somehow whenever there's like money that we want for a specific thing, it's too much, you know. So I think that was a lot of what we had to overcome.
Okay.
And we did that through different ways. We debated them openly through public forums, in newspapers. We called them out. They made a couple key errors throughout the campaign. Like at one point they recruited a bunch of immigrant businesses for some flyer or something. And they were like, oh, we don't support PCF because it's going to raise our prices for our customers. But like these people were not going to get charged at all. So we went to go visit them and we found out like, oh, hey, these people don't speak English. They had no idea what they were signing up for.
What?
Yeah, there's some newspaper articles where we called them out on that.
What?
Won't they do it?
They'll do anything, man. My experience.
Yikes.
I'm not a friend to PBA. I'm not worried about them getting mad at me. But they'll do anything. I mean, they're pretty sus in my experience. So they another thing they did was like Reverend Edie Mondanay, who has since been called out for some stuff, but he ended up like going to, I do feel like I should mention that. He went to the PBA offices at one point to try to talk to them, and they called the cops on him. He's a black man, for folks who are not familiar with that. And so we were like, well, okay, here comes our, like, we're going to call some journalists. We're going to like make some noise. And so we got pictures of them actually trying to arrest Reverend Mondanay. And so I think we took a lot of tactics like that like on our comms strategy. We had a really great comms team. Jenny Lee, who works at CCC now, and Damon Motstory, who also works at CCC. We got them both.
That was some recruiting there. MVP recruiting.
Shout out to Marcus. but yeah, so we ended up being able to like really fight them off on the comms game. I think that really helped. I think the other thing we did was we were everywhere. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing a lawn sign, without seeing like something about us, which was great. We got some, and then we also did things like at different cultural events, different like festivals and stuff. Representative Con Pham and I, at the time she was working at Apato, we put together like a street performance skit where we had superheroes who represented the three pillars of the PSEF program, clean energy, jobs, and green infrastructure. So we had these superhero costumes we made, and then we had a Monopoly Man type costume that we made. And so the Monopoly Man would like say, you know, a bunch of bullish, and then we would have like the superheroes like challenge him and they would defeat him. And it was a really fun way. It was very satirical and funny. And it was a fun way to have like people kind of get access to like the talking points and to inoculate our folks to like, hey, this is what they're going to say. Don't listen to them. So that's all like the calm stuff we did. But I think our biggest resource was we got this really great field director named Jessica Beckett, who ended up organized whipping us into shape, and we did so much grassroots organizing. I mean, I was on calls all day long, knocking on doors, talking to as many people as we could, and we did culturally specific grassroots action. So we would, for example, when we were working with Apano, we would have them recruit folks from their community that spoke the languages in their community, and we would have those folks go out and knock on doors. Or within the indigenous community, we're like, maybe not send a bunch of white people to the door, and the black communities as well. And so we would send people that represented those communities, that knew those communities, to do like the real outreach and engagement. And then, you know, we had a really large volunteer base. We had about, I think at largest, we had about 8,000 people involved in the campaign. Wow. So this small group of field organizers was just constantly going through the Rolodex, the volunteers, trying to get people to phone bank, to knock on doors. And it really was just a community effort at the end of the day. I mean, we were outspent, out like maneuvered in some cases, but we really worked hard. So then eventually I think PBA stopped throwing money at it. I think they realized based on polls and based on different things that they weren't likely to win. At least that's my impression, because I kind of stopped seeing them as much. I would see their lobbyists pop up, you know, but like nothing really super public. They weren't pouring a ton of money into ads or anything. And so at that point though, they went to the state capitol and they passed they put into one of our big bills, the Student Success Act, a little line item that said, no other jurisdiction outside of Portland can establish a business license surcharge fee.
Wow.
So they basically wanted to make sure we couldn't repeat what we did, because that was definitely our plan. Our plan was definitely like, okay, first Portland, then Oregon, like, which we still did in our own way, but they put up a block on that. And you know, we had to like make peace with that, to be honest, because we wanted the Student Success Act to pass. So many people had worked so hard for that. So it was, so they've used a variety of tactics. And then post-campaign, they started playing the kind of nuance game. They came into negotiations with the mayor and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty and the PSEF Coalition, and they were arguing with us about what should be exempted from the measure. You know, so we ended up reaching a neutral kind of place where we're like, okay, fine, like we can agree on these three pieces. And that ended up stripping about $10 million from the bank, but we had campaigned on $30 million, and then we found out we were actually raising $60 million. So we were kind of like, you can take the 10, that's fine. Yeah, like, we still doubled what we thought we were going to get out of this, so farewell, have fun.
No biggie.
So and then last year, like the week I started was March 13th through the 16th. So that was the weekend that the pandemic picked up, at least in Oregon, where everyone stopped going into work. And I was starting my new job like on this weekend. And PBA showed up at the mayor's office, had a private conversation with him, and then shortly thereafter published this letter that had a bunch of sign-ons. that it wanted to get out of a bunch of different taxes and surcharges and fees that corporations are supposed to pay to do business in Portland, mm-hmm. But particularly the name PISA. And so we had to organize a big letter to challenge them on that. It was a really easy case though, because like, I don't know if y'all remember, but everyone was going out buying toilet paper at that point in time. So we were like, yes. Y'all are making like a ton of money from people yeah. like stocking up
yeah.
to stay at home. So no. and I think wow. I think I got in trouble with PBA a little bit. That point, because you know they were mad at me because I think I said at some point they were like trying to imply that they represented BIPOC communities in some way, and I think I said something to the point of like it's audacious that they would claim that. Like, I got in trouble from them for that line, but I don't regret it. I own it to this day. That's audacious, y'all. Like,
yes. Yeah, yes, y'all are wilding. Mm-hmm. So have you seen a difference in the community engagement or the enthusiasm for clean energy projects since the passage of PSEF?
Yeah, I mean, I think it changed a lot of the ways that at least organizations in my circle were able to operate. I mean, one, we had way more political power. Okay. Two, we were way more well-known. Like people knew who we were and were familiar with us. And then I think we just started, like, we really built a base, I mean, from that campaign. So when we came out of that campaign, we came out with a much larger base than we had coming in. Oh, and yeah. so suddenly the movement had grown, like, overnight to this much larger ecosystem. Yes. And then we were able to take it statewide, which is, like, a whole other conversation. But I'm really happy that we, like, took that opportunity and just kind of ran with it to the state mm-hmm. level. And took over all of our coalition building, because I think it's gonna, I just want us to keep growing and I want us to keep building power. And I'll be honest, the best way to do that when you are outspent is to simply have the numbers behind you, the numbers, people who will call them every day and bug them every day. You know, I think one thing I do worry about is like in this pandemic Zoom age, like I'm noticing with city council and stuff, I don't know how much they're really listening to us. So I kind of feel like we're moving into a more direct action territory that needs to start to happen. And we need to like utilize this people power we've built and start protesting again, because that's apparently that's what they listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. The public shaming does not go well.
Apparently not. I don't know. It would work for me. I would not be able to look myself in the mirror at night.
Yeah. What would you know? No, no.
I say something wrong on this interview and I'm like going to stay up all night thinking about it. Can't imagine.
Who are some of the different stakeholders that you're currently engaged with?
Yeah. I primarily work with other frontline community groups. So some of the big ones that I currently work with a lot are Verde, Opal Environmental Justice, APANO, NAACP of Portland, Imagine Black, Portland Harbor Community Coalition. Shout out to them. They're doing really good work. And then I think also, let me think. Then on a statewide level, we work with folks like Rogue Climate, Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians. We work with Lake County Resources Initiative is a new partner that's really cool. Y'all should look into them. They're doing really great work in Lake County, where like in this rural part of Oregon that has almost no energy infrastructure. I mean, a lot of people still have wood burning stoves in their houses.
Wow.
Like, so like working in those communities is really interesting to me. Yeah, and I think my kind of approach to partnership work is like I focus most on the people who are most impacted first. You know, and then I work my way out from there. Like, so I try to focus my relationship building on like those communities, and then the allies that we have who are really great. I've noticed they started to hire more BIPOC staff, and thankfully they seem to be able to retain them, which is even more important in my opinion. Yeah. And so I'm seeing just a lot of BIPOC leadership in all of these different spaces, and it gives me a lot of hope. You know, the movement is growing in terms of because we've become so successful at our particular approach, which I think is the right approach. You know, now it's kind of harder to say no to our grant applications. So that's good. So we're getting more money in the movement. I'm seeing more positions popping up, and that's really exciting to just see that happening. And I think PSEF is part of that as well, because I know some organizations were able to, you know, increase their staff capacity quite a bit I think about DePave, for example. DePave like was a one woman show for a long time, and now they're growing fast. And what DePave does is they literally DePave concrete areas, which is the particular interest of mine. I'm really excited to see some more trees in Portland. We already got a lot of trees, but they seem to be all in the center of the town.
So then what are some of the biggest obstacles of getting buy-in from the various stakeholders?
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle, frankly, is capacity. Like, can you get everybody to a meeting? That's hard sometimes. Yeah. Like, just that can be really hard. Like, I know it sounds silly, but like, I'll be honest, like that can be the hardest thing about a meeting is like, you plan a meeting and then you come in and you're like really hoping that this one person's there because you kind of like, what really want to know what they think. And then last minute, they're like, I can't come. And you're like, damn it. Hey, I really wanted to know what you think. So that requires a lot of one-on-one conversations, frankly, like a lot of like following up with people, taking the time to do phone calls, to do emails, to like get their opinion sometimes ahead of time if they say no earlier, and I can get a heads up about it. Oftentimes I'll be like, I need your opinion on this. And then when we're in the room, I think it's all about kind of balancing the need to like recognize our differences and recognize our commonalities and sort of refocus the conversation as you can when appropriate, because sometimes it's not. Sometimes those differences need to be named. They need to be there. They need to be present, and we cannot get around them. That's what it is. But they're most often in my spaces, we share so many values that it's often about like coming back to, okay, like we disagree on this one thing, but like, look at all this other stuff we got in common. We'll be all right. Like, and just kind of reminding people that like, that's sort of the cheerleader aspect of my role, I guess, is like reminding people of like, we're not that different. And I think I have this particular experience in this just because my parents are so conservative. And I often find myself trying to find places of common interest with them. Mm-hmm. And they often get distracted, the differences, but I try to bring us back and be like, every time I talk to them, every time I have a political discussion or argument with them, I always try to bring them back to, hey, this is where like we align. You raised me. So I'm in with me, and I can't quite pull that card with my colleagues. They did not raise me. So they have no say in how stubborn I might be. But like, I think with my colleagues, it's always like, hey y'all, like, we're in this together, and especially with like the white dominant environmental groups, you know, because I think there's a sort of idea that there's not enough power to go around. And I fundamentally disagree with that. And so I think kind of bringing us back to, there is enough power. We can all have power. We can share power. We can collaborate around our power. If one of us builds power, that's good for the other one. And when we can get to that point, I think people kind of start to break down their walls. And then unfortunately, a lot of it is interpersonal relationships. It's a lot of it is just like, who likes who gets along with who, like, and that can be some of the toughest bits of the work, frankly, because after those values and like you get everyone in the room, it could be people who are like super values aligned, but they might not like one person in the room and they might not want to say what they think because of that one person. So the interpersonal relationships play a really heavy role, I think. And I think I think for the most part, we've been set up really well for that though, because like our, you know, coalition leaders who like started this kind of movement more or less, really kickstarted it. Their foundation was, we're friends. Like I remember Alan Hipolito, who works at Suma now, but used to work at Verde. He would always organize these happy hours on Fridays, like once a month or so. And it was no work Fridays. So you could come to the happy hour. We all worked together, but we could not talk about work.
Hey.
No work. Leave it at the door. Which was challenging for me as a young organizer who didn't needed to know a lot of stuff to come in and not ask like Tony from Latino Network a bunch of questions like when I had access to him. But like, you know, but I do think it really served to like build a relationship. And we would just go dancing together. We would just like hang out. And even still, some of my closest friends are people I work with every day. And I think when we can really get to that point of it, that community centered, like that community, like we do this work because we love the people we work with, and we know we all want the same things, that can kind of keep the pressures a little lower. And then, frankly, I make a lot of dad jokes. I'm a big joker, so I just provide a lot of levity in spaces as much as nice. I can. I think of a joke, I say it in the chat. Yeah. Sometimes nobody finds me funny at all, but that's okay. I'll get over it.
Nice. Yeah, a joke of mine fell flat earlier today in the meeting, in the Zoom meeting. I was like, did my audio go out? Like, no one
like,
laughed.
Like, you know it's
No one laughed. And I was like, oh, I'm going to nail this. And, yeah. Didn't
sometimes they land flat, man.
Yeah. And it, luckily, in the Zoom spaces, you can just turn your screen off right quick after you.
Now, that's a weird thing that has gotten easier about politics is, like, it's a weird thing that's made it easier and harder. It's easier when you're the person that's like, I don't want to talk. I don't want them to see my expressions. I'm just going to turn my camera off and they won't know what I'm thinking. Which is much better than, I mean, I've always been told I have a terrible poker face. When I would go into meetings and I'd have an opinion and I couldn't just like put a black screen in front of my face and be like, goodbye, y'all.
You might need to get a picture of yourself printed so you can just have that in the meeting, just put that in front of the camera.
I really would love if someone, like, I could see one of my colleagues, Damon, they're pretty campy. I could see them, like, bringing a black screen to a meeting and just putting it in front of them. I couldn't have the conversation anymore. I could just see it, like, the roll-up.
The black screen just says camera off.
It just says their name and their pronouns. That's made it easier when it's a tough conversation, I would say. And usually with tough conversations, everyone's really engaged. But when it's easier conversations or just kind of the day-to-day work, I find that the distance between us with the pandemic is harder to navigate because, you know, kind of every meeting does kind of count, even if we're just talking about a budget or we're just talking about a work plan. Like it all kind of counts because we only have so much time, and I like to make people's time valuable. So I will say I'm a frequent, like, oh, we've done 45 minutes in, let's just go. we're done. No reason to keep going. Like, I had a 5-minute phone call. I was supposed to have a 15-minute one last week, and the person I called was really busy, and I was like, okay, well, I got everything in. You got any questions? Okay, I'm going to let you go. Bye. So, yeah, I think it's just the pandemic's really changed a lot of things, obviously, for everybody. I think it's also, like, made us question a lot about, like, what we're doing as a movement and like what's working, what's not working. And for example, like we didn't have any really like bilingual spaces before the pandemic. Now it's like a cultural norm. It's like, of course you got a bilingual space. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you have an ASL interpreter? And I think those sort of things I'm excited to see transfer into the real world. And I am a little nervous about my poker face because don't think I've improved it. But I'll come with it. You know, everything has its pros and cons.
Right. So we have the holiday coming up. And this holiday is usually one where families gather together and someone's going to bring up an uncomfortable conversation at the table.
I would never.
So this is where we're going to try to give them some talking points, some crib notes. What are some of the conversations that members of the community can have to help bring awareness to clean energy initiatives?
I think we can talk about the reality. This might open up a big box of worms, but if I'm going to be honest, the reality that a lot of our energy systems are inherently extractive, and that's connected to the larger way our economy functions. And that's connected to the history of that holiday in itself. Of like, why do we have Thanksgiving? It really was a colonial celebration, let's be honest. And and that really was the little seed that kind of grew into this extractive economy. And, you know, I'm sure no pilgrim like imagined what the world would be today. I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure they had no idea. But regardless, what they did was they planted the seed of exploitation, of extractive, of the idea that some people matter and some people are not smart enough to matter, or they're not good enough to matter, or they got the wrong skin color. to matter. And I think those seeds are like really what the climate justice movement is looking at undoing in our own way. I think everybody has a contribution to this undoing over time of colonialism. But I think in clean energy in particular, we're talking about reframing our whole economy, because the fossil fuel, I mean, our economy is pretty much a fossil fuel economy at this point. Right. Mm-hmm. Everything, like my cabinet might be made out of some fossil fuels. Like you'd be shocked to like, what has fossil fuels in it? Like a lot of things do. Mm-hmm. And we've built this world that is unsustainable. And I think we also have to take ownership over that. I think we have to be grateful. I'm a pretty spiritual person. So, but like for me, I have to be grateful that like my ancestors lived and my ancestors gave me this opportunity and worked as hard as they did to give me the opportunities I have today. And so I have to do everything I can do to be the best ancestor I can be. And I'll be imperfect, I'm sure. I'm sure if I have kids, they'll come complaining to me about me too. But but like, I want to do the best I can, knowing I'll always fall short. And I think that's really what I'm looking at when I look at the clean energy economy and the transition. I think that's what gets me so excited about it, is that reality that we're going to do better than we did before, that we're going to improve the world for future generations. And that's like what drives me to work every day, is, you know,
we love that.
That dream is that vision.
Dope. That's dope.
So to wrap it up and just give the listeners out there something, what are some final words you would like to impart on their ears?
You should get involved. Even if you think that you're not an expert, I was not an expert coming into this field. I felt like when I got hired, like I had a lot of imposter syndrome about being involved in this field. I felt like I should be a biologist or something. And I didn't understand my own contributions, but I'll tell you, like the further along in the work you do, you get the more you see what you have to offer. And while what I have to offer is like mostly like relationships and humor and good like communication, that's all really valuable stuff right there. Yeah. Like that's really valuable. And for a long time, I didn't see that. So whatever your thing is that, you know, you're really passionate about, that you're really good at, that like really helps you wake up in the morning, you can apply it to an activist work. You can apply that to other things. So don't feel like, you know, you have to be a subject matter expert. You have to know everything. You'll learn. People will teach you. People will mentor you. But the first step is just to get involved. And I guess with that, like, I don't know if this is time for calls to action, but
it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
With that, I would say here's a couple ways you could get involved. So you can pay attention to the PSEF grant committee meetings. They're open to the public. You can join via Zoom and you can provide public comments. They are really kind of technical meetings, but they are interesting, especially when they talk about you know, outcomes and what the goals of the program are, and you can have a really big voice in shaping that. And you can also reach out to the staff to get involved in their different subcommittees as a community member. Those are open committees. So you can inquire around, find what committee you might be interested in. I would pay attention to the energy justice bills and their implementation in the new year. So those bills are 100% clean energy, energy affordability, and healthy homes. And this is all under the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. Mm-hmm. So you can go to our website. You can see how to get involved there. There's going to be a ton of opportunities for community members to give public testimony, to speak up, to support good implementation of those bills, because we've passed really good bills. We need to implement them really well for them to be successful. And we need community to help us do that. And then finally, I would just say, you know, come check out, you can go to the Portland Clean Energy Fund Coalition's website. You can go check out any of the groups that, there were over 200 organizations that endorsed the measure, and there's 10 steering committee organizations. So there's a huge network of groups in this community that are doing awesome climate justice related work. So they could be labor groups, they could be, you know, environmental groups, they could be BIPOC-led organizations. There's probably an organization where you would enjoy spending your time and volunteering. And they probably have something that, you know, I think for me as a volunteer, I'm always like, please don't load me up for too much stuff. So a lot of these organizations, I think, would be good also with you if you need to set boundaries, if you've got kids, if you've got, you know, accessibility needs that you need. I know a lot of our folks were really big into childcare in the movement. So there's a lot of ways that you can get involved. A lot of opportunities are stipended these days, so you can get paid a little bit of cash to participate in certain like community events, certain like gatherings, anything that says a listening session on it, you might be able to get paid for that. So pay attention to things like that too, that come out of the government, because there might be opportunities for you to get a little bit of cash for your time, and you could also do some activism.
That was awesome. That was it. I really hope you guys learned as much as I did in this conversation.
Right. I feel that worth the notes over here.
Thank you very much. I'm going to need you to share those at some point. Maybe take a picture with your phone. If you could. If you could send me a fax. If you could fax those to me.
What's the Chegg? Is it Chegg? The website, the like where you share college notes and. I'm way too deep in the world.
Okay.
You gave me.
But the important part is the joke didn't land flat. Thank you guys for tuning in. Lisa, thank you for your time. We'll catch you guys.
It was a joy. Thank you so much.
Yes. We will catch you guys on the next episode. All right. Peace.